one or two generations, or we'd be lost. Monogamous marriages would be disbanded, social norms broken for the sake of a richer gene pool. That morning, of course, we were speaking hypothetically. Who knew that within a year, two of the married partners on our coastal tribe would be drawn to each other, and I would become a single dad? At the edge of the world, tribes come apart. Survival takes its toll. Down the coast, the scrawny black spruce woods of the north turned into temperate rainforests, towering with hemlock and cedar. The world felt as if it were opening, blossoming. Away from ice-bound wastelands and Arctic coasts, the South has always had more of everything good. A Boeing 737 half-cargo plane, making a milk run through the unroaded towns of southeast Alaska, dropped us in Wrangell, a coastal town 600 miles downcoast from Prince William Sound. Three parents and four kids had left us by now. They went back to their lives after we'd been motored off of the Sound from a hired boat, three wave-smacking hours back to the glacial enclave of Whittier, Alaska. Our tribe had shrunk to two boys, my wife, and a support crew of two friends. Our Umiak was now a rented minivan, with an interior stripped to metal and a bench seat in the back. It had old brown blood on the seats, elk, deer, or bear. The back was dirtied with needles and bark from hauling wood. We drove it out of town and camped in a forested park along the beach, where we readied food for an inland backpack. A stream flowed through the rocks and giant red cedars. Our tents had popped up in the woods like mushrooms, and in the morning we loaded packs, getting ready to leave. My wife, Reagan, stuffed sleeping bags while I cooked breakfast on the camp stove. The boys had made a kingdom at the top of a 20-foot-tall root bundle from a fallen cedar, its trunk the size of a bus. This is what kids do when they land in new territory. They make it home. I heard a cry and saw Reagan sprinting toward them. Only one boy was up in the roots, the other was gone. I flipped the stove to off and ran. Reagan knelt in the stream below the fallen tree. Our youngest, the snail whisperer, lay face down in the water. She slid an arm beneath Jado and cupped the back of his head as she rolled him over. His eyes fluttered open, head pumping blood. Stream water, gravel, mud, and cedar needles matted to flaps of skin, a door the size of a cuckoo clock's open in the middle of his forehead. His skull was exposed. You worry about your children all the time. The tone of your voice, the chemicals in food, the socks they can never seem to find. You build a nest for one purpose, and you shall not fail. But now, at this moment, I did not worry. My body was only a tool. I sprinted for my pack, calling to our friends, the firefighter and the street cop, "Head injury!" I yanked open my pack, hands diving in. The backcountry kit was buried too deeply. We needed compresses, now. A stack of boxer shorts came out in my fist, washed yesterday at the coin-op in Wrangell. These would do. I ran to the water where Reagan was still looking down on Jado, telling him, "You're okay, you just hit your head really hard." I could tell from behind that she was smiling at him, his eyes locked on hers. I laid the compresses above his eyes, folding the doors of his forehead closed as she checked toes and fingers, and Jado answered calmly, shocked. When we pulled into the clinic parking lot in Wrangell, it was clear and sunny, the kind of day you pray for in southeast Alaska. Reagan held the boy, his head packed in bloody laundry, as one nurse calmly got on the phone and the other, equally unstirred, pulled out trays and readied the gurney. Jado was fully conscious, no tears yet, and as Reagan laid him down, the nurse pulled off our compresses around dark red clots, exposing what looked like a volcano in his forehead. The doctor arrived within half an hour, wearing a denim vest, cowboy boots, and a battered leather multi-tool on his belt. It was Sunday morning. He was unshaven. The only two nurses in the clinic were swabbing and patting to slow the bleeding. "Let's have a look at you," the doctor said, looking upside down at the laceration in the boy's forehead. Pulling on latex gloves, he introduced himself and said with a smile, "Did your brother push you?" Jasper's eyes widened with shock. His mother touched his hand, smiling. He didn't mean it. Jado had been too stunned and bloody to cry. Then a nurse handed the doctor a syringe with a needle, and he began to resist. With his head on a pillow, he started asking rapid-fire questions, anything to keep that needle away. The nurse held down one shoulder, and the second nurse came in to hold down the other. Soon, both Reagan and I were pushing him back down as the doctor moved in with the needle, and the boy began to wail, rattling every glass in the room. He was going to be fine. It has never been easy to lose a child, not now, and not in the Ice Age. I'd thought about this on the kayak portion of the route, finding the fawn crumpled up from a fresh grizzly kill. The girl with limpets on her fingers, the boy talking to snails. When these are the ones you take care of, the space between life and death can be uncomfortably thin. Any of us would have died for the kids in our group, regardless of whose kids they were. A tribe is technically defined as a social division consisting of interlinked families working toward a common goal. In a simpler sense, a tribe may be the people whose children you would die for without hesitation. Human remains throughout the Paleolithic tend to come from children, not adults. Consider the oldest three people found in connection with the first American colonization, a Siberian discovery known as the Malta Boy, 24,000 years old, the approximately 13,000-year-old Anzac Boy, excavated from a cave in eastern Montana, and the 12,900-year-old remains of a young teenage girl who was recently found in the bottom of an underwater cenote in the Yucatan. The boys from Siberia and Montana were toddlers, both carefully buried, both with red ochre. The girl found in Mexico was older, and she may have gotten lost or fallen and died alone. She represents the southernmost human remains from the Ice Age people who started in Eurasia. In my mind, these three kids seem like a myth, magical siblings spanning 11,000 years, two brothers and their older sister from Beringia, coming into a new world. In a watery cenote, the girl returned to the earth, sowing into the land the arrival of the first people. Anzac Boy was between 1 and 2 years old, discovered in 1968 during construction on the Anzac family land near Wilsall, Montana. His skull and bone fragments were in a horizon of rock flakes and large, artful projectile points from what is known as Clovis technology. Bifaces covered in red ochre and laced across his bones. The bones were roughly treated after discovery, kept in boxes, and handled by many. Their radiocarbon dates were contaminated, but a piece of antler buried above the boy is about 13,000 years old, putting him later in the litany of arrivals. 98% of the DNA extracted from his remains belonged to bacteria that invaded the bones during decomposition. 2% was human, though, enough to construct the oldest recorded human genome from the Americas, one more closely related to Native Americans than to any other group worldwide. It is also related to gene flow from the boy interred 24,000 years ago at the Malta site, a complex hunting village in eastern Siberia. The Malta boy from Siberia wore a bone bead necklace with a bird-shaped pendant, and around him were burial artifacts including a Venus figurine, a female form fashioned in a style known from Siberia to France. This boy was part of a movement across the Mammoth Steppe, similar artifacts connected over thousands of miles. His genes belonged to a now-extinct population that contributed to Siberians, Native Americans, and the Bronze Age Yamnaya people, known also as the Ochre Grave Culture, who lived in Eastern Europe north of the Caucasus between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. His DNA carries no signatures from Central Asia or East Asia, which means he was pure Beringian. Only later did coastal genes reach his descendants on their way into the New World. The Yucatan girl represents the oldest, most complete human remains in the Americas, a mostly intact skeleton discovered disarticulated on the bottom of a cenote. Naya, they called her, Greek for a water nymph. Her skull, resting upside down, was found by divers at the bottom of a spring called Hoya Negra, the Black Hole. She may have become lost in the cave and fallen into a chamber more than 100 feet below. When sea levels rose, groundwater was pushed upward, drowning the chamber, encasing Naya in fresh water along with the bones of a gomphotheer, a kind of extinct elephant, and an array of extinct predators that must have fallen in as well. Given the watery state of her preservation, only mitochondrial DNA could be extracted. The matrilineal bloodline, representing yet another Eurasian and Native American connection. Part Malta boy and part Pacific Rim, she belongs to a thread of mothers who came from the other side of the world. Paleolithic human remains tend to be children, not because their bones are somehow more long-lasting, but because their bodies were more likely to be cared for. The Malta and Anzac boys were intentionally buried rather than left to the elements. Naya was preserved by chance at the bottom of her hole. The doctor closed Jado's wound with 16 stitches. Soon the boy was sitting up with a blank look on his face, the letter Y ladder-tracked down the middle of his forehead. We went back to our camp that evening at a beach outside of Wrangell. Tide logs were stacked up, whole trees washed in over the decades. We dropped in a tangle of long, naked tree trunks, sheltered from an evening breeze coming off the water. Reagan sat against an ocean-polished cedar, our little boy in her arms. Jado's face was drawn from painkillers, and his older brother crouched beside him, holding his feet in their small socks. In the bronze light of one of our last Alaskan sunsets, he was still a bit stunned. Reagan brushed her hand around his belly like a slow clock. She sang softly to him. I have wondered if the ochre, the fire, and the care of bodies represent layers of sadness, if they tell us something about love in the Ice Age. Adults may have been left on the ground after death to be scattered by weather and scavengers. Children were different. Their loss felt more acutely, cared for even in death. They were, they are, true hope. Three children were buried at different times in the floor of a hut in central Alaska, in what is called the Upward Sun Site. The hut was made of poles and skins 11,500 years ago. The next oldest after the Malta, Anzac, Yucatan trio, these three lived and died in the Tanana River Valley, the next major drainage south of the Yukon. Two are infant Ice Age girls who came from two different mothers and were both buried with grave goods. In a lair above the two baby girls were the cremated remains of a child about 3 years old and of unknown gender. Two pieces of red ochre were found among the burned bones. Based on the soil horizon, he or she must have died after the two infants, possibly in a different season. The cremation fire was set in the hut's central fire pit atop layers of earlier fires, salmon bones, muskox, horse. It was the last fire lit there. After this, no one ever came back. The cremation happened at the warmer end of the Ice Age, when Alaskans could burn wood instead of bone, and so the fire was made of poplar wood. It lasted from 1 to 3 hours and was never stirred. The skeleton remained in position, intact. I imagine the adults leaving through a door flap, letting the light in, shafting through the smoke. The doctor with the stubble and cowboy boots told us we could backpack, to treat the boy as if he were healthy, just make sure he didn't knock his bandaged head on anything. On a point of land 1,000 feet above inlets and islands, we set up camp, looking down the ragged chain of the Alexander Archipelago. Waters were calm, streaked now and then with the courses of gillnetters circling for salmon. We saw very few boats or people. The land before us lay empty. Beyond blue courses of water, beyond the horizons of forested islands, stretched the rest of the continent, south of the ice sheet. 800 miles left to go. We traveled the rest of the way on the MV Columbia, the 418-foot-long flagship for the Alaska ferry system, room for 280 cars in its cavernous two-story belly. It was named after the nearby Columbia Glacier, which was named for Columbia University and its early expeditions mapping ice in southern Alaska. The university itself was named in 1784 in honor of Columbia, a quasi-mythical female symbol that came to represent America, the New World, and eventually the political fervor of manifest destiny. In an 1872 painting, she appears as a woman drifting over the prairie in a white flowing dress, a spool of telegraph wire over her arm, leading miners, railroads, stagecoaches, and homesteaders westward, while bison and Indians flee before her in terror. Columbia was, in turn, named after Christopher Columbus. The name on the side of our ship bore more than a whiff of colonization, the conquest of and expansion over land and whatever people and animals once inhabited it. It is a concept this side of the world has known for a very long time, that urge to fill an emptiness that never existed, except in the minds of those yearning for untamed vastness. Our giant umiak rumbled through the Alexander Archipelago of southeast Alaska, where glaciers pour between islands and peninsulas, offering shelter, breakwaters, from the wild Pacific. At night, the twin 9,000-horsepower engines thrummed us to sleep in a tent on an aft deck, the metal under our sleeping bags beating like endless galley drums along the Ice Age coastal route. Reagan, prone to seasickness in even calm waters, had flown ahead. Our tribe was down to three, a father and two sons, one still bandaged from an injury. That might be as good as you could have hoped for after a long journey down the ragged coast in the Pleistocene. I found myself leaning on the wet railing, watching the darkening, temperate forest glide by. Defiles of fjords and islands on either side, waterfalls cascading into the sea. How many eyes looked back, I wondered. Grizzlies, black bears, caribou, moose, wolves, elk. Orcas sank away unseen, and humpback whales breached, sending up jets of mist. In the last 17,000 years, this coast has only grown richer, denser, more green, where glaciers have rolled back and back. Having spent most of my life in drier, sunnier places, I'd fallen in love with this coast and its density of life. It drew me on, as it would have drawn tundra hunters. Northern people are known for their mechanical ingenuity, repairing machine parts with bone or leather, calculating the friction wear on skins used to replace belts on engines. In the Ice Age, they would have easily whipped up boats, lashing skins and wood together to reach some richer-looking island or bay that could only be accessed by water. Prince of Wales Island, 100 times the size of Manhattan, passed on the starboard side of the ferry. The island, made mostly of karst limestone, has caves where spelunkers and researchers have found Ice Age bones, one of the few places along the northwest coast not entirely swallowed by ice during the last glacial maximum. Animals lived here back then, most of the caves revealing an abundance of Pleistocene bears. A report from one cave reads, "Along with 4 black bears, the remains of at least 3 brown bears were recovered, one of which was gigantic." The caves also produced late Pleistocene fleas, nematodes, and signs of black spruce, marking this corner of southeast Alaska as an Ice Age refuge, a place where people could have landed by sea even during a glacial maximum. Prince of Wales Island was one of the genetic seeds that would repopulate coastlines as ice retreated. While fossils on nearby islands experienced a hiatus during the last glacial maximum, they kept going on Prince of Wales. Along with giant bears, the remains of Ice Age caribou were found in caves, as well as bones of ringed seals, indicating the presence of pack ice. One of the island's caves, called On Your Knees, held the remains of a man who was about 20 years old when he died 10,300 years ago. The oldest known human remains found on the northwest coast, long after the first people would have come through, ended up in the back of the cave. Large bite marks on the fresh bone suggest that his death might have been violent, or at least that his body was scavenged and dragged back here. The cave's entrance has produced thousands of flakes and stone tools, including stemmed projectiles and leaf-shaped blades, their dates less certain, but likely in or near the Ice Age. Some of the tool stone found on this island suggests that people were living here by 11,000 years ago, traveling by boat and land over 100 miles to particular rock sources and bringing back regular supplies. They must have known the country at least well enough to be aware of the best rocks within 100 miles, some of the sources far inland between glaciers. The human bones from On Your Knees were claimed by the local Klawok and Craig tribal governments of the Tlingit tribe. They named the person Shukaka, in English, the man ahead of us. Tlingit is an indigenous coastal group of hunters and gatherers. They erect totem poles carved with ovoid eyes of animals, their art similar to that of the indigenous Ainu from the northernmost island of Japan on the opposite side of the Pacific. Their genes connect them directly to Shukaka. When the bones were found in 1996, local tribe representatives were immediately notified. The 2 Tlingit tribes agreed to have the remains studied, concluding that the body had not been intentionally buried but was dragged into the cave by scavengers. How the dead are treated makes a difference. This man had not yet received a proper burial. Washington State University molecular anthropologist Brian Kemp found that Shukaka's closest genetic relatives can now be found along the west coast from here to the bottom of Chile, defining an ancient route of migration, one that was probably established long before the man ahead of us lived and died. Shuka Kaw was buried in 2008, his bones and teeth placed inside an intricately carved and painted wooden box, the red image of the man on the front of the box guarded by raven and eagle. Prayers and smoke were given to the remains, and the box was placed in the ground at an undisclosed location. A gray slab of rock was erected at the site, and on it these words were incised. Shuka Kaw. We have lived in Southeast Alaska since time immemorial. Shuka Kaw is testimony to our ancient occupancy on this land, born circa 10,300 years ago, died circa 10,280 years ago, September 25th, 2008. Ernestine Hayes is a Tlingit memoirist, scholar, and state writer laureate for Alaska. She spoke with me about these bones and the people who came before her. She said, "Raven found people in the clamshell, and people who are here have always been here since time immemorial." I asked what these words, immemorial and always, mean, and she said they indicate an actual bracket of time, something that both story and science can help define. She said that this was not some impossibly mythic past, but something the people remember, not necessarily a land bridge, but another kind of emergence, a shell washed up, carrying the first people. "The land bridge is what people who follow the religion of science tell themselves," Hayes said. "I think both can be true at the same time. One just happens to be dominant, a product of colonialism." Hayes mentioned a well-known Northwest tale, how the raven used to be white and came to be black. Like all good stories, it means more than it seems, and she thought it might hold answers for my questions about Ice Age arrivals. Raven, the trickster god, lived along this coast. Raven was white then. Not that it mattered, this was before the world had light. All was bathed in a skeletal darkness, where you could make out the softly glowing bluish shadows of trees and figures, but little else. There were no days, no nights, no seasons, no stars, at least not until Raven came along. A figure named Grandfather kept the sun, moon, and stars inside a wooden box in his house. The box would have looked something like the one that now holds the remains of Shuka Kaw, painted and decorated. In some stories, it is said to have been carefully inlaid with small cowrie shells. Raven tricked his way into the house through a classically complicated and devious series of events involving Raven impregnating himself into a young woman who gave birth to him inside the house. Grandfather believed he'd been given a grandson, a spoiled and demanding grandson. When Raven was old enough and saw his chance, he threw the lid off the box and light flooded out. Raven was brilliant in the light, as bright as snow. He snatched the sun, moon, and stars and tried to fly out through the smoke hole, but he got stuck in the hole, caught by what he'd stolen. Grandfather rushed in and found the thief trying to get away. He built a fire beneath the struggling bird. Finally, Raven burst through the hole, trailing sparks and smoke behind him, and released the celestial bodies into the sky. Singed and burned, Raven was now black, shiny as charcoal, the color we see today. But the sky that we know was now in place too. Hayes told me this is a story about the end of the Ice Age. "We know that animals that live around snow and ice are white in color for much, if not all, of the year," she said. "Along with the retreating of the ice, the white bird went away with it, and Black Raven came up to explore newly uncovered ground." I asked Hayes if anyone was here before the Tlingit. "Archaeologically speaking," I said, "there should have been people here before Shuka Kaw died 10,300 years ago. I was looking for people who were on this coast when Raven was still white, when the world was being made." She said, "The oldest stories are about people who came from inland when the ice melted. They found people who were already here. Those people probably came by water." These were the people I was looking for. The accumulation of evidence suggests that the first migrants into the Americas came along multiple routes and at different times before, during, and after the height of the Ice Age. It was not a single, small colonizing population, but many separate arrivals. When Hayes mentioned another people here when the Tlingit arrived, I used the word First Americans. She reminded me that this was not America then. She implored that I think differently about the history of this land, saying that people were not becoming American, but becoming Tlingit, becoming Navajo, becoming Lakota. Some lived in the thick of the Ice Age, and some arrived to see it end. In college, I spent a summer on a $700 grant along the Northwest coast. It was my first time in the Pacific Northwest. I was nearly broke and barely old enough to drink, but I had a driver's license, so I got the hell out of where I was living as far away as I could go. Perhaps it was my D4, the dopamine receptor that marks wanderers. Perhaps it was the memory of my mother's highway umiak urging me to go. I headed north, traveling in bush planes from Squamish to Bella Coola, up the British Columbia coast, almost to Alaska, trading labor for flights. The grant was for an interview project with Canadian bush pilots. I flew in beavers and Cessnas, taking off with an old one-eyed pilot in Williams Lake who lit the engine on fire as we left the ground. He flipped switches until the flames sucked back in, then grinned at me saying, "That's what happens when an internal combustion engine becomes an external combustion engine." I helped carry boxes, groceries, mail, medical supplies. As we flew over mountains and blue inlets, I saw more wilderness than I'd ever imagined, nameless mountains and glaciers folding over each other. It felt like the immensity would burst my heart. I saw waterfalls thin as floss coming down steep mountainsides, their clean gray waters milking the blue-green ocean below. My suspicions about the world were confirmed. It was wild and empty. I stayed longest near Bella Coola, a small town 60 miles up a narrow inlet. It is the seat of the Newhalk Nation, which has fought for at least two centuries for their territory, battling first the Russian explorers and hunters who tried to claim it, then smallpox epidemics, then the arrival of highways and airplanes. The entrance to their red-painted lodge is made into a mouth at the base of a totem pole. My memory may be faulty, but I recall a storytelling evening, looking up into the rafters through the drifting smoke and seeing a small, mirrored disco ball, left over from the community dance. Recording in notebooks, taking film pictures on a tank-like Pentax, I spent every other day or two in the air, mapping the land with my eyes, taxiing into logging camps and native villages, landing on water, snow, or washboard dirt strips. When I wasn't flying, I sat at my camp beyond Bella Coola, watching bald eagles bicker over roosts, their great dark wings slapping at one another. Using driftwood and pieces of discarded pier, I built a small hut above the cobbled high tide line. It was just large enough to sit inside or curl up in for a nap. I hung interesting items around the entrance using found fishing line, a couple eagle feathers, bits of wood, pieces of colorful plastic. When it rained, which seemed to be most of the time, I sat in the hut, evening clouds rolling through, sea and sky the same blue-green. In the crooked oval mouth of my shelter, I felt like a shaman. I was the tip of the rat's whisker, finding the way, leading edge of my people. For the Newhalk, who gathered in Bella Coola's hall, coming in and out through the mouth of a totem pole, I was simply another arrival in a land that has seen many. The entrance to Bella Coola slowly opened and closed as the MV Columbia rumbled by. I wondered if the old wharf was still up there, and I thought of what this place had looked like from the air, a maze of fjords and mountains, what is called the Great Bear Rainforest, extending along 250 miles of the coast of British Columbia. West of here, the islands are crumbs and slabs shrugging off into the Pacific. About 15 miles west of the inlet to Bella Coola is Triquet Island, a gob of rock and temperate rainforest, a mile from side to side. An excavation there found an Ice Age settlement under layers of peat and soil, where, based on arrays of samples, a carbon-rich fire hearth was used sometime between 4,086 and 13,613 years ago. Researchers led by Alicia Gavreau, a PhD student with the University of Victoria's Anthropology Department, have uncovered wooden artifacts still intact from these oldest layers. Bits of wood fish hooks, a hand drill for starting fires, the throwing arm of an atlatl, carved wooden points, and a carved stick wrapped in bark. Gavreau presented her finds in 2017, pushing settlement dates along the coast here farther back than ever before. These may be the people the Tlingit ancestors encountered when they arrived on the coast north of here around 10,300 years ago, the people that Hayes said came by water. 10 miles down the coast from Triquet Island is Calvert Island, where, if the date holds, the oldest human footprints in North America have been discovered. Like Triquet, Calvert has also maintained a steady sea level since the late Pleistocene. University of Victoria archaeologist Duncan McLaren of the Hakai Institute directed a crew at a beach site, peeling back layers of gravel and sand. They opened a group of human footprints associated with a nearby stone-lined hearth just above the high tide line. Charcoal from the hearth came back dated 13,200 years old, the possible age of the prints. People had stepped in a fine clay-like mud that took their impressions, leaving 12 distinct tracks, an adult, a second smaller adult, and a child. A left foot and a right foot show the gait of someone walking, the heel pads, toes, and the arch of the foot, those of an Ice Age person on the BC coast. The oldest human footprint in South America also lies along the coast. A child's track found at Monteverde along the Pacific edge of southern Chile. The excavation of Monteverde revealed a robust human component 14,500 years old and less robust sequences going back much farther. As the Columbia continued through widening waters, I was aware of the rest of the coast ahead, a route unfurling beyond our destination, one of the longest and more or less straight-lined coasts in the world, stretching from here to the bottom of South America. The direction we traveled felt like a drumbeat, the rhythm of a course of migration written in the water. The West Coast was a relatively busy place in the late Pleistocene. 13,000 years ago, on the Channel Islands off Southern California, people lived among and probably hunted horse-sized pygmy mammoths and utilized stone tools of Pacific Rim-stemmed tradition. Such finds are strung down the Peruvian coast to Chile as well. Remains of deep-sea fish have been found in Peruvian excavations, evidence that people were not spearing or netting from shore but were using some sort of craft to reach open water. In from the arid coast of northern Chile, a trenched red ochre mine was first gouged out of an iron oxide vein 12,000 years ago. The history of the colonization of South America is wholly different from that of the North. South America in the late Pleistocene was the farthest large habitable place on Earth, reachable only by small and vigorous parties. Compared to the front door offered by the Bering Land Bridge and its coast, the southern continent may have taken more D4 to reach. It is doubtful that Polynesians arrived then, their gene pool reaching the Americas only in the last few thousand years. These were coastal travelers, and they came down from the north. One study of Native Americans aimed at solving the riddle of the first people found that their genetic similarity to Siberians decreases the farther they got from the Bering Land Bridge. This is a chromosomal trickle-down from north to south, people beating through geographic gauntlets, their genetic connection to their starting place stretching thin the farther they went. Until 3 million years ago, South America was geographically separate from North America. When tectonic changes lifted the Central American land bridge, land animals passed between the two continents in what is known as the Great American Interchange. In its time apart, South America had bred its own pair of saber-toothed cats, Smilodon gracilis and S. populator, the two species sundered by the chain of the Andes. Giant armadillos and club-tailed glyptodonts with shells of hardened hair made it as far as Mexico and the American South. A hoofed camel-like animal lived below the equator, larger than a horse and with an extended proboscis, like a short trunk, its nasal opening above the eyes on top of its skull, remembered now only in the fossil record. With the two continents connected, late Pleistocene boat travelers had no reason to stop their southern advance. It was a long, unbroken line. The stone projectiles they left along the way were stemmed, with the nub of a tail sticking off the bottom for securing to a shaft. Stemmed projectiles are found at On Your Knees Cave in Alaska and at Cueva Fell in southern Chile, an 11,000-year-old Paleolithic rock shelter near the tip of South America. They have appeared on the coast of Peru, California, Oregon, and British Columbia, as well as across the ocean in Japan, Kamchatka, and on the Kuril Islands. This is the earliest sign of a singular people connected by a unique Ice Age technology along one contiguous coast. Kelp ran out in the warmer waters around the southern tip of Baja, California. This point of land in Mexico is relatively abundant in Paleolithic material, as if it were a diving board, launching the people southward in search of cooler waters where the kelp would resume. They would have had to paddle another 3,000 miles to the top of Peru before kelp beds reappeared. Evenings would have begun to cool as people traveled south of the equator. Chile would have begun to feel like Northern California, but with different plants. Around the modern-day Northern Patagonia city of Puerto Montt, glaciers emptied into the sea, blocks of floating ice populating the traveler's route as they found themselves back in the sort of world they once knew in Alaska. Perhaps they believed they were making some kind of circle or a spiral, the world turning back on itself. The open-air site of Monteverde, along the southern coast of Chile, is one of the key Ice Age human appearances in the New World. It is one of the early emergence sites, a village, or at least an encampment returned to over thousands, if not tens of thousands, of years. It lies along a creek set back from the coast. There are signs of complex and multi-layered occupations, with woven fish weirs and the remains of 12 hide-covered huts, with 112 wood posts used in their construction, still partly intact. These rectangular huts, floor plans ranging from 43 to 170 square feet, were joined along their sides and arranged into two parallel rows. The layout of stone and bone artifacts on their floors, hearths, trash middens, and workstations suggests the places were residential. A 13th hut was found nearby, the floor plan wishbone-shaped, its artifacts hinting at the preparation and use of medicinal plants, a healer's dwelling, perhaps a shaman's hut. The foods eaten in Monteverde ranged from seaweed to mastodon. The people were generalists, hunters, gatherers, fishers, scavengers. No bones or teeth have been found, so their DNA has not been extracted. Who they were is unknown. For now, they are just people, but their projectiles indicate a Pacific Rim connection by way of the Siberian coast. Vanderbilt University archaeologist Tom Dillahay, who has led the multinational interdisciplinary excavations at Monteverde, wrote, "Assuming that other late Pleistocene people operated under similar subsistence and settlement practices, our data imply that if groups traveled along the Pacific coast, they may have migrated slowly and exploited the interior resources of the hundreds of river basins descending the long mountain chain from Alaska to Tierra del Fuego. Migrating slowly, as Dillahay suggests, would have allowed them to learn of food resources and places to find good tool stones. But to have reached Monteverde, ahead of most other sites in the Americas, they had to have been driven, pushing toward Chile at the same time that inland travelers were following rivers into North America. As if drawn by the emptiness, these people went as far as they could. Sites appear more quickly than they should if people had moved and populated the way that modern hunter-gatherers do. Instead, they filled spaces like fast water, either by coast or inland. Todd Surivel, an archaeologist specializing in the Paleo-Indian period at the University of Wyoming's Frisson Institute, wrote in 2000, "It is quite possible that the Americas were populated very rapidly by highly mobile hunter-gatherers. Whether they still carried an atavistic wanderlust from breaking out of Africa long ago, or they reproduced in unusually high numbers, an adaptation seen in pioneer species, such as coyotes or pigeons, which reproduce at an increased rate while populating empty regions, the first people moved at a swift clip. A 2016 study of 7,200 radiocarbon dates from early hunter-gatherer sites in Colorado and Wyoming backs up Surivel, concluding that these people achieved long-term rates of population growth comparable to the rates of population growth achieved by prehistoric New and Old World agriculturalists. Dillahay describes a slow coastal advance, but other archaeologists have seen it as a race, people who couldn't stop paddling or reproducing until they'd spread all the way down the coast. Surivel constructed a model to estimate the possible speed of Ice Age coastal migration, starting near Seattle, the maximum southern limit of the Cordilleran ice sheet, and reaching the bottom of South America. He imagined a minimum population of 175 people within a 1,000-kilometer strip of coastline and sent them leapfrogging south at a 3% growth rate. Each generation in his model could only move as far as 200 kilometers before optimal density was reached, and new migrants moved yet farther south in search of new food sources. Under these controls, the fastest Surivel could get his people from Seattle to Monteverde was 2,267 years. Traveling from Alaska to Monteverde does not have to take that long. Any boat traveler seriously questing for the edge of the earth could cover the span in a year or two and be back before their departure was forgotten. I spoke with a young adventurer, a kid out of Juneau, who traveled mostly by kayak, sometimes by bicycle, from his hometown in Alaska to southern Chile. By human power alone, Kanan Bowsler had managed to cover the exact distance traveled by the first people. He was not a sponsored expedition, no magazine articles or photographers went along to cover the adventure. It was simply what he wanted to do after college and a couple of jobs, much like me on the Yukon at the same age. This may be how the continents were first explored, small numbers out to see what they could see. Kanan Bowsler's intended destination was Tierra del Fuego, the southernmost tip of South America, another 1,000 miles from where he ultimately stopped. Bowsler, 23 at the time, was able to cover 8,400 latitudinal miles along the western edge of the Americas in 2 years. He passed from the glacial north to the glacial south, with bands of desert and rainforest between. Seeing him as an ice age proxy, I asked what the world looked like at this pace. "In a sense, it was unremarkable," Kanan said. "The change happened so slowly that each night didn't change that much. When you're constantly seeing something different, it's not an epiphany." Kanan's epiphany arrived not overnight, but in the last few 1,000 miles. 20 months after leaving Alaska, passing beyond the unbearable heat of Central America, Kanan saw fresh snow again from his kayak in Peru. Down the coast of Chile, the moon kept turning until it was fully upside down and all his northern stars were gone, replaced with new constellations. Here, the coast began to look familiar. Temperate forest came down to the shores, mountains rising, glaciers tumbling into rivers and bays among islands and fjords. It looked as if he had, somehow, returned home. The place Kanan decided to stop is, for me, an epiphany. He pulled over near the city of Puerto Montt. Not far from the city, a river runs to the sea, and it passes by the Monteverde site. He had no idea of the archaeological significance of the region, but he ended his journey here. He had reached serrated islands, inlets, and sheltered waters. As much as he wanted to complete his original goal and reach the tip of South America, the feeling of homecoming was irresistible. He had to stay. It is my belief, not through any archaeological evidence, but because of the shape of the land and what Kanan did when he got there, that the Monteverde archaeological site was established because it reminded early boat travelers of their home. Whether their journey was a quick shot like Kanan's or something that took many generations, a complex expedition with grandparents and children in tow, people ended up at Monteverde, what one scientist told me was the Gilligan's Island of the Americas. Kanan left Juneau for South America at 23. He didn't return to Alaska for another 3 years. But he did return, and that matters. He was able to tell his family and friends about his journey. Unless the traveler returns, no knowledge can be passed on, no map will be laid out, no later migration of families will occur. Kanan came back and told the people of Juneau what he saw. He told them he'd passed beyond countless horizons, and at the far end of the world, he found a familiar place with unfamiliar stars and an upside-down moon. Who could resist such a call? Did the first people imagine the shape of the earth? They might have known the general shape of the planet. They had enough information to compare the roundness of the sun and the moon to what was beneath their feet. Or perhaps they saw it as a platter of earth, a flat or perhaps slightly curved land around which sun, moon, and stars perpetually revolved, passing into the underworld before rising again. Or maybe it was far more complicated, and with their extra 5% of brain volume, they took in the geography differently than we do. Those traveling down the Americas might have found a doppelganger of the northwest coast in Chile and thought that the world was folding over itself. They were returning to a similar place, but it was not exactly the same. I have traveled into the coastal ranges of Chile and Patagonia, and they feel like Alaska, their islands and glacier-horned peaks dead ringers for places I'd seen in northern latitudes. Rowing a raft down the Rio Bacar in Patagonian Aysén, coming out on its brackish graywater delta, I could have been coming out of the Stikine River into the inside passage of coastal Alaska. What comes to mind is the topological concept of a Klein bottle, a single non-intersecting surface that wraps around itself. If you traveled across it, you'd find yourself returning to the same point, only upside down. Beaching their boats on the ragged coast of southern Chile, they may have been puzzled at their new but not so different environment, as if the world were a woven basket and you were moving through its circular warp and weft. Kanan Bowsler made the trip, and I believe that sometime within the colonization history of the Americas, an Ice Age individual must have done the same. Surivel's model for a 2,267-year journey from the coast of North to South America leaves out a crucial factor, something another archaeologist pointed out to me. I was visiting an excavation on a tiny island off the coast of southern Maine, where I rowed a white wooden rowboat to a dig site. The excavation at Smutty Nose Island was bringing up the foundation of a 1770s Revolutionary War tavern, and below it were Paleo-Indian stone tools and weapons. The University of Southern Maine crew was led by archaeologist Nate Hamilton. Sitting along the trenches where his crew had found buttons, coins, a ceramic pipe, and down deeper diagnostic stone weaponry, Hamilton said he thought archaeologists are missing the point. He asked why people reaching the West Coast would have crossed the continent for Maine, when there would have been plenty for them to eat and drink along the way, no practical reason to keep going. Why leave California? Why leave the fertile Great Plains? "What's over that mountain and that one?" he asked. "Adventure. It's one thing archaeologists don't credit enough." Adventure is not in Surivel's model. How much D4 were Ice Age people packing? I go back to Diane Hansen's warning that scientists tend to make early people look like themselves. Perhaps people had more verve than we do today. They may have picked up the pace, felt compelled to move, pouring into empty spaces. Kanan Bowsler puts the journey from Alaska to Monteverde at 2 years, assuming that you dawdled like he did, fishing and buying tacos along the way. If you were moving kids and grandparents down a coast, I'd add another year or two for safe measure. So how long would it have taken for boat travelers from the Pacific Northwest to reach their mirror image in southern Chile on this Ice Age coast? A ballpark figure, 2 to 2,267 years. Night by night, the skies darkened down the outer rim of British Columbia. Stars came out, the first we'd seen in weeks. Coastal towns began to appear, more lights on shore, more boats in the water, more float planes in the air. The temperate world was opening, allowing for more and more life. Cruise ships appeared like ivory castles on the water, and humpback whales breached and sent up jets of mist. On our final night, we plied the backside of Vancouver Island. Lulled by the Basso engine deep inside the ferry, the boys were finally asleep. At the far southern end of the island, which passed darkly on the starboard side, the fragment of an arm bone from an unusually large Arctotis, the short-faced bear, was found. Its chemical conditions suggested the bone, along with the rest of the carcass, was deposited in a steppe-like grassland environment, now a forested island coast. The Arctotis bone has a radiocarbon date of about 22,000 years old. Nearby, a mammoth leg bone was found, 17,000 years old. Further south, on Orcas Island in Washington State, the bones of a 12,000-year-old bison, Bison antiquus, were found, butchered by human tools. South of that, a 13,800-year-old mastodon skeleton was found on the shores of the Olympic Peninsula. The animal lay on its side, with a projectile made of sharpened mastodon bone embedded deep into its spine. I quietly unzipped the rainfly and slipped out onto the ship's deck. Skies were partly clear, a handful of stars in the almost black. Other travelers had bedded down under a nearby solarium. A few headlamps were still on. I saw a bearded, rough-looking young man writing in a journal. I'd noticed him when he came on board in Wrangell. He had the shell-shocked look of someone who had wandered out of the wilderness and wanted nothing more than to return to it. This was our last night, and I wanted to say hello. I grabbed a bottle of red wine I'd bought in Ketchikan and headed over. He said his name was Josh. He thanked me as he held out a metal cup, and I poured it half full before doing the same with mine. He said he'd just finished a solo 1,000-mile kayak voyage, starting in Bellingham, Washington, ending in Glacier Bay, Alaska. Now he was on his way back home, his kayak stowed below with all the other vehicles. If he went again, he said he would take longer. I told him I'd always thought of going north to south, and not the other way around. His journey seemed almost against the grain. It's not like it's downhill, Josh laughed. I poured more wine, asking if it felt like a superhuman feat to go that far alone. It could be done by almost anyone with half a sense of adventure, he said. Really, I think people don't know what they're capable of until they get out. Josh told me how free he'd felt, how good it is to go on a journey and explore the world around you with all your senses, and how strange it is to come back to engines and exhaust and busy sounds of people. He told me that a month wasn't enough. I'd recommend 3 or 4 months, he said. However long it takes, the longer the better. We drank half the bottle. I said goodnight and left him the other half to curl up with. A welcome back to the human race. In the morning, I woke to the blast of the ship's horn. I'd accidentally slept in. My head ached. The boys were out cold. A voice came across the PA saying that in half an hour the Columbia would be docking in Bellingham. Boys, boys, it's time to go. We've got to hustle. They moved slowly and made ungrateful noises. I shook them and said, "You have 30 seconds, then I'm pulling you out." The older boy came up snarling, and the younger, with stitches in his forehead, burrowed deeper into his bag. It was a sunny day in Bellingham. The small coastal city came around us, and the ferry ran its engines in reverse. The ship shuddered against wooden pilings. Our tent was still up as campers cleared out of the solarium, and a purser came around making sure passengers were leaving. Shoving and jamming books, playing cards, and sleeping bags into packs and pouches, I snapped my fingers, telling the boys to pick up their pace. Breakfast was whatever I unwrapped and got into their mouths. Blood sugar dropped faster than I could counter. The interior spiral staircase of the ship wasn't large enough for all the bags and packs at once. The boy in front bickered with the one in back, so much gear draped awkwardly around us that we were more like luggage than a family. Someone cursed loudly. It may have been me. I stomped onto the metal gangplank that connected the Columbia to the continent. I had been planning an auspicious entry. Maybe I'd release a pinch of ochre to the breeze while saying out loud, "Welcome to the land of beavers that stood 6 feet tall and Colombian mammoths from here to Mexico. Welcome to Devil's Tower, the Grand Canyon, the Ozarks. Welcome to the Colorado River, the Gulf Coast, the Rocky Mountains." I said none of this because straps were digging into me. At the far end of the gangplank stood Reagan. The boys ran to her while I came behind them, carrying almost everything. Red-faced, I reached the concrete and dumped gear on the ground. This is how we arrived in the new world, damn it. Chapter 5. Playground of Giants. 45,000 to 15,000 years ago. In 1781, Thomas Jefferson learned of a man who had returned from what was then the frontier, describing bones that came from creatures bigger than any known living land animal. Jefferson wrote that a Mr. Stanley, taken prisoner by the Indians near the mouth of the Tennessee, relates that, after being transferred through several tribes from one to another, he was at length carried over the mountains west of the Missouri to a river which runs westwardly, that these bones abounded there, and that the natives described to him the animal to which they belonged as still existing in the far northern parts of their country, from which description he judged to be an elephant. In Jefferson's era, mammoths, or at least the bones of mammoths, were seen as the remnants of creatures from before the Great Flood. He'd heard of a find at Bone Lick, Kentucky, where many mammoths had left their skeletons in place, as if they'd died during drought or hard times, which they had, though not in some impossibly ancient time. The bones were still bone, not yet mineralized into actual fossil. Jefferson did not know that human artifacts of equal antiquity would be located among the mammoth remains of Big Bone Lick. He had his suspicions, though, and Mr. Stanley's report intrigued him. Running westwardly from the Missouri would have put the man on the west side of the Continental Divide. Jefferson thought that if creatures like mammoths still existed anywhere on Earth, they might be somewhere out west, lost in the unexplored country of his people's new continent. In 1803, Jefferson sent Meriwether Lewis to Big Bone Lick to acquire some of these mysterious remains, hoping they might help him better understand the place of man and beasts on God's planet. The following year, pleased with his success at collecting mammoth remains from the state of Kentucky, Jefferson sent Lewis and William Clark to the head of the Missouri for an expedition into the American interior, where the president hoped he might hear something more about mammoths. The expedition returned with a tale of a vast and well-inhabited continent, many languages and incoming rivers, but no sign of living proboscideans. More than a century later, James Teat, an anthropologist who gathered ethnographic stories in the Northwest, alongside the famed Franz Boas, who later became known as the father of anthropology, published tales from the Kaska people of the northern British Columbian interior. In a footnote to his 1918 study, Teat wrote that he heard of a very large kind of animal which roamed the country a long time ago. It was of huge size, in build like an elephant, had tusks, and was hairy. These animals were not seen so very long ago, it is said, generally singly, but none have been seen now for several generations. Indians come across their bones occasionally. A Penobscot story from Maine, recorded in 1934 in American Anthropology, tells of a hero figure called Snowy Owl, who was searching for a wife far to the south. He noticed that the watercourses were drying up and followed up a valley to seek the cause. He saw what seemed to be hills without vegetation, moving slowly about. Upon closer scrutiny, he saw that these masses were really the backs of great animals with long teeth, animals so huge that when they lay down, they could not get up. They drank for half a day at a time. Snowy Owl went on and, after many adventures, secured his wife. Then he returned to the place where the animals had their yards. He cut certain trees upon which the monsters were accustomed to lean at night, so that when they did so, the trees would break. Thus the animals fell upon the sharp stumps, and Snowy Owl shot them all. Could this be a story about hunting megafauna into extinction? Oral histories are not hard data. Scientists turn to them for much-needed context, for a voice to give texture to artifacts and paper, but all stories change over time, bending and bleeding into new traditions. Indigenous mammoth tales could as easily be reflections of scientific discoveries, people adding back to their stories what they have learned from their own past. When researchers and collectors came from far away to dig up tusks and giant skulls in Siberian permafrost, Ugric speakers living there might have given these long-gone beasts a name, Earthhorn, Muxar. Delving deeper than oral tradition, returning to original bone, I followed Dr. Sue Ware into a storage hall in the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, where boxes were stacked and limb bones and vertebrae rested on shelves. A pair of reassembled direwolf skeletons was posed running across the top of a storage cabinet as if taking over the place. This part of the museum was originally the Ice Age Hall. I knew it from when I was a kid living in Denver. Quaternary murals scrolled across the top of the walls, skeletons assembled upright, mammoth and mastodon returned to their original heights. The hall was now closed to the public and filled in, stuffed to the gills, temporary desks and offices made between crates where space allowed. Ware walked through exhibits, turned into storage, pausing frequently to point out some bit of knowledge or specimen, a beautiful short-faced bear skull, the pelvis of a giant ground sloth that, as she noted, could comfortably seat two. Ware and I are old friends. We've messed around in the museum together from way back, opening predator jaws and peering inside for sheer amazement. Ware studies large fossil and modern carnivores, calling Ice Age North America the playground of giants. She has a mischievous grin when she talks about the bloodbath of the Ice Age. Her dissertation is on pack behavior among extinct American direwolves. When I was a kid and came to the museum on school trips, I'd drop coins into the mouth of a hard plastic saber-toothed cat just inside the entrance. I remember the cat's head and shoulders on a wooden box like a bust, mouth open wide, saber teeth curved. Coins disappeared down the dark hole of its throat, and from inside the box a roar would come out. I could have fed that cat coins until all my lunch money was gone. The voices of classmates echoed off limestone floors and columns holding up the ceiling as we filed in. Once inside, teachers could scarcely keep us together. I was on a mission. I passed the tank-headed Eocene herbivores and other pre-human oddities. I liked the dinosaurs enough to have a geeky glossary of their Latin names in my head, but the prehistoric animal I believed in and was enthralled by, the gigantic beast that human beings actually knew, was the mammoth. I stood beneath its curved golden tusks, the skeleton upright above me, Mammuthus columbi, the Colombian mammoth, the thing Jefferson hoped to find alive in the wild American interior. Its skeleton was bolted to the ceiling with metal rods, as if all it required was the word to break free. My return to the museum this time was for the same species, M. columbi.